Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Welcome to Change Leaders Exclusive. I'm your host, James Dallas. Today's topic is breaking barriers in education. We have two outstanding guests with us today. We have Dean Erica James of Emory University's Goswetha School of Business, and Gary Humphrey, President, ATP, and also Vice President of Sales for Adapture. You can contact us through Twitter, LinkedIn, and also Facebook at HJamesDallas, hashtag ChangeMaster. Now, let's begin with our guest, Dean James, Erica.
Yes.
Talk to us about where you're from and also what influenced you the most growing up. Let's learn a little bit more about you.
All right. I was actually born in Bermuda. My parents, who are American citizens, were living there working at the time that I was born. But we moved fairly soon thereafter back to the United States. And I claim Texas as home. We moved around a lot, but I grew up in Texas and went to school there through high school, and ultimately went to California for college and Michigan for graduate school.
You are extremely smart.
Thank you.
Could have gone a whole lot of directions professionally. What caused you to go into education?
I come from a family of educators. So my mother is a teacher. She started out teaching music, as did my father. Then she later switched over to teaching special education. My father continued to be a music teacher his entire career. So I was very accustomed to that environment, but I never saw myself as a teacher. My stepfather was a clinical psychologist, and so I spent most of my life growing up with him and learning about how people behave and why people do the things that they do, which I found fascinating. So I went to college and studied in psychology, and I knew that I was going to want to earn more than I could make from a bachelor's degree in psychology. So I went on to graduate school in organizational psychology to get a PhD. And what I learned at that point was the PhD is preparing you for life in education, higher education. So it was not necessarily intentional, but it worked out well.
Gary.
Good morning.
Morning. Gary, talk to us also. Give us a little bit better feel for your background and also the events and the people that influence you.
Sure. Actually, I was born in Chicago, but actually I claim Georgia as my home where I was raised. I've been here since I was a young lad of 6 years old. Went to Dunwoody High School, University of Georgia. Yeah, I did not pursue education as strongly as my colleague here, Dr. James, but ultimately, I know that education is really what sets us apart and gives us the opportunities to succeed. In life, you know, it's, I think adversity makes us stronger. Some personal adversity I've gone through in my life, you know, has built me up. What I go by, one of my values and one of my guiding principles is I really try not to worry too much about things, as we discussed earlier.
When you talked about success, mm-hmm. When I think about why am I hosting this show, it was because of people like you. Educators played such a tremendous role in my life in opening up my mind and also in opening up doors. But there were some things I had to do. In fact, some risks that I had to take mm-hmm. in order to prepare myself to go through those doors. Can you talk to us a little bit, starting with you, Erica? Mm-hmm. What are some of the biggest risks that you have taken in your career before?
Sure. Well, not surprisingly, I think most risk is a function of change. Anytime you change something, my changes were usually precipitated by leaving something. So early on, I remember I was in graduate school and earning my PhD, and I left in the middle of that program to go to New York and work for a real company. I thought I wanted to try my hand at having a real job. people told me, my dissertation advisors, my faculty, my colleagues, they said, oh, you're never going to come back. You're going to go and get accustomed to making money and you're not going to finish your PhD and what a loss that's going to be. So it felt like a risk to leave the environment of school and education to try out working for a while. But sure enough, I ended up having the opportunity to collect my dissertation data where I was working, and I did go back and I did get my degree and finished in almost record time. So it worked out. But it was a risk to leave that environment. And I can give you one more example. Later in life, I was teaching at the University of Virginia, and I had already earned tenure and I had established myself as a faculty member there. And I had the opportunity to go teach at the Harvard Business School. You know, for someone of my background and whatnot, that was sort of the ultimate opportunity, if you will. And it was pretty fearful. And it was a risk for me to leave an environment and a context that I knew to go and teach what in my head were considered to be the smartest, most elite, most prestigious students and at an institution that was the best in the world. And would I be able to make it and be successful there? Felt very risky at the time.
How did you overcome that fear? Because I hear that a lot. We refer to it as FUD, fear, uncertainty, and doubt,
yes,
and the ability to fight the FUD. So here you are going to Harvard. So how did you fight the FUD?
I had a little help from the economy. So I went in 2008, and that was the year of, obviously, the economic downturn. And I remember walking into class on that first day, and my heart was thumping, and what am I going to say to these students? And I looked out at the students, and all I could see was FUD, fear on their face, because they had just made the biggest risk of their life to leave a secure job to go to graduate school at a time when they were watching the economy tank in front of them. And would they be able to leave and have a job and the earning potential that they were expecting? And they knew many of them would be going into debt as a result of their time there. I thought, how can I help these students? And it was less about me, what can I do to teach you, and more about what can I do to help you? And that was a fundamental shift in how I thought about education from that point on.
Gary, you heard from Erica about the risk. But now let us hear from you. What are some of the biggest risks you've taken in your career? And then what drove them? And then how did you deal with that uncertainty?
Mine was a decision based on success, actually, in corporate America, to go and try my own, hang out my own shingle start my own consulting firm in the 2004. Right out of the gate, you know, I was stepping towards something, not stepping away from something. But the circumstances changed immediately once I set up my consulting business. The business model shifted within 3 months based on a partnership that I had, and I had to reconstruct right away. So we did, and we moved forward successfully until 2008. As we all know, what happened in 2008, nobody really wanted contractors or consultants, and many companies were downsizing. So I ended up stepping back into corporate America, not thinking it was a failure, but thinking it was a wise decision based on the circumstances.
Wise decisions. I think one of the wisest ones that you have made has been to become president of ATP, the Association of Telecom Professionals. What causes you, Gary, to give that time in addition to working full time in a very important role? What is driving you?
That's a great question. It is a completely volunteer organization. You know, 16 years run by volunteers from day one. No one receives any kind of a salary or paycheck. I talk about within the organization, it starts out with a simple yes. I answered a question in 2011 from Karen Finger, who got me involved, a good friend of mine. And coming out of one of the personal adversity times of my life, she said, would you like to take on this challenge of helping me with sponsorships with ATP? And I said, yes, definitely. And then from then forward till today, I've continued just to say yes to the next challenge that they put, you know, before me. And the leadership team there just found that I would be a good person to run the association for this 2-year term. So I'm very proud and honored to be in that position.
You're a very humble man. Mm-hmm. What Gary brings that anyone who has met him and those of you who will meet him. He has that special ability to get people to work together. Now, the association consists of over 1,000 professionals in telecom. And we all know how telecommunications are fundamentally changing everything, and especially education. But the association impressed me with all of these high-powered telecom professionals coming together to learn. And I think that's the mission of one of the missions of the association.
It is. It's actually, it's interesting, James. You know, we try to go by ATP nowadays because when you say telecommunications, people don't find it as relevant as it once was back when we started 16 years ago. So ATP, we try to say it's really about awesome technology people. But the foundation is still there. Everything that needs to be connected, right? Everything that we do from apps to, you know, mobile devices to smart homes, smart cars, it's all riding on communications of some sort. But it's more business relevant in financial services, automotive, retail, et cetera. But to your point of education, yes, ATP supports two organizations. One is TAG Ed, which really helps high school students with internships and also to just promote education for high schoolers and college students. And then also Power My Learning, which is a great organization that helps students more in the K-12 arena get the right tools and have a successful opportunity to succeed, whereas previously they may not have that opportunity because of their financial and economic situations.
So you're bridging the digital divide.
Totally bridging the divide, yes.
Now, Erica, Gary's bridging. You're breaking.
Uh-oh.
You're breaking some of the educational paradigms out there. Talk to us about what changes are you driving at Emory? And for those of y'all who may not know my background, I'm an alum. And my career took off after I got my MBA at Emory because it broadened my total perspective. I went in there as an IT professional. I came out as a business professional. So Erica, talk to us about what changes are you leading and why?
This is such a critical time in higher education, and particularly business education. And I'm grateful, actually, to be sharing this show with Gary, because so much of what's important right now is working collaboratively across business and a variety of other types of needs and responsibilities and professions. So one of the things that we've been very adamant about doing is linking technology with business. So the last decade or so, the STEM field and the support for STEM has been very, very strong in the amount of corporate support for advancing STEM with our students from K-12 education into higher education is intense. And what we say is technology, engineering, math, sciences are all valuable and critical. And it's people who are doing those. And part of what people need are the fundamental analytical skills, people interpersonal dynamic skills, communication skills, writing skills. And so being able to marry both the technical and technology expertise that we're creating in the world with what the skill sets are needed to run an economy, run an industry, run a business, I think will make for very, very strong students going out into the world.
Not only make for strong students, but it also allows them to get a job.
Indeed.
That's always helpful.
Which every parent wants.
and that's the power of what you said about linking education and business. What are some of the, I don't know if barriers, if that's the right word to use, but what are some of the challenges that need to be addressed in order to make that linkage even tighter?
Well, there are several challenges in higher education, one of which is the value proposition for higher education in particular. So with the advent of significant new forms of technology, there are a number of different ways that you can deploy education. And so for those of us in traditional college university settings, it's really beginning to understand how do we appropriately use technology to advance the kind of learning that will make for the leaders that we need in this world, not have technology just supplant education in its traditional form. But we also recognize traditional forms of education have to be buttressed by what technology can provide. And so I think we need to get away from the either or and find ways to work collaboratively to bring technology into meaningful ways into academic settings. And, you know, you look at the needs of students, education is expensive. And how can you provide education in a way that's less costly, but as effective, and helps them get the education they need in the time frame that they need? So not every student is wanting or can afford to have a four-year experience, or even, you know, 6 or 8 years if they go on to graduate school, but they still need access to the information and the learning. And this is where technology can really help drive some of the advances in how education is delivered, but it's got to be done in tandem and not in either or.
Gary, Erica talked about education in an academic setting. Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about it from a workplace setting. Because if you're working, let's just say you are a vice president or even a manager, mm-hmm. with the changes that are taking place, it is even more critical now that you are a lifelong learner in order to stay what I call employable, mm-hmm. as opposed to just employed. How are you all, and when I say you all, ATP, also your company, mm-hmm. thinking about how to educate people in the workforce?
Right, that's a great question. It's technology is changing so quickly. It's the cycles are so tight as far as innovation. It's hard to be a generalist. Like in the past, you really have to be a specialist, and you need to surround yourself with other very capable individuals. So more now than ever, it's important to build out a team that's very complementary in its skill sets, and really promote education, teamwork, collaboration, all the things that actually that are starting to be learned in the higher education system. You need to continue that learning, that collaboration into the workforce, and you need to be prepared to be able to change. Erica mentioned, she made a change and went into, the real work life at one point. You got to be willing to take those risks and not, I always say you have two ways you're making decisions, fearfully or powerfully. You don't want to be in that position where you're being met head on by the change. You want to, in my opinion, you want to run out and meet that head on, to be a change agent, to be really to stay in control somewhat of your career as things change in the industry, in the market.
For our listeners who are just tuning in or who tuned in after the show started, you're listening to Change Leaders Exclusive. Today's show is focused on breaking the barriers in education, both in the academic setting, and also in a workplace setting, with our guests, Dean Erica James, and also Gary Humphrey. Dean James, back to you.
Yes.
You are extremely young, and so are you, Gary. I know you've already started thinking about your legacy, though. What would you want it to be when people think back on your tenure as dean?
Well, that it does feel premature to start thinking about a legacy, but I realize every decision, every action one takes is leaving a legacy of some sort. And what's important to me and the reason why I entered education and have stayed in education is largely about having a positive impact on the lives of young people. And the more I can do and the position that I have, being able to have that positive impact in my world, in the business school at Emory, that's manifested in a number of ways. It's how do we ensure that we have the most innovative, up-to-date curriculum so that our students are going out into the world prepared for the business challenges that they will face. The legacy is around making sure that we're able to provide the resources that we need to our faculty to do the world-class scholarship that will help solve the business challenges and that will become the fodder for the textbooks and the learning material that our students will use. And so I'm in a position to be able to help facilitate the resources that allow those things to happen. And I think the more we start to see changes in the curriculum that meet the needs of the students and that meet the needs of the workplace, boy, that's a legacy you can't beat, because you talked about lifelong learners. You're preparing people to be lifelong learners.
You mentioned young people. What about us forever young people?
Yes.
And the program you have at Emory, the executive MBA, takes us forever young people and actually makes us younger by exposing us to what is taking place holistically in business. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the executive MBA program?
Sure. So we have the executive MBA, which is a degree program for more senior executives, if you will, who want to earn their MBA degree. We also have what's called our executive education, which is a non-degree program. So you were talking with Gary a few minutes ago about lifelong learners and how do you bring education into the workplace. That's what executive education is about. It's utilizing the faculty and the research and the scholarship that they produce to prepare short classes or short courses, maybe a week at a time, that gives them access to new ideas, new things to refresh their experiences in the workplace. So I think for, what did you call yourself? A forever young?
Yes.
I think the forever youngs really value being able to partner and participate in these non-degree executive education programs that will facilitate their skills at the moment that they need that skill in their workplace.
Gary is a young person, not a forever young person.
I'm in that forever young classification now.
But Gary, in order to stay forever young, you have to be able to carve out time to learn. You're extremely busy. You're vice president of a big company. You're president of a large association. How do you find time to learn?
You have to schedule it out. I mean, it's really about your routine. For me, it's early mornings. My brain operates much better in the morning. It starts fading in the afternoon. So I know when, 4 a.m. hits, I'm up and at my day. You gotta plan for it. Is there like anything else you work out, right? You have to plan for it. Spend time with your kids and your family. You just gotta plan for it. You gotta make it part of what you want to do. You gotta dedicate yourself to it.
Erica, we heard about how Gary plans things out. What does your schedule look like?
Well, I can tell you I'm not getting up at 4 a.m.
I don't really want to. I can't help it anymore.
But I am a relatively early riser. And like you, the morning hours are where I feel the most productive. And so if I'm able to carve out some time in the morning to do some of the thought work that's required in my job, that's when I get that done. The rest of the day is usually spent in meetings or engaging people in the community or working with our students or doing some of those things. But if there are activities that really require thought power, then I've got to get that done first thing in the morning.
One of the things I've noticed about you is that whenever you meet with someone, you spend more time asking them questions instead of giving answers or talking about your platform, which I found very encouraging and also refreshing. You are very inquisitive. Is that just your nature or?
I think I am a very curious person, but I also believe that an inquiry approach to leadership is a more powerful approach than believing that you have all the answers and you're just going to advocate for your position. So I tend to learn a lot more by asking questions. And I think the nature of questions and the role that questions play in getting people talking elevates the conversation and allows for new ideas to come out that wouldn't have come out if I or someone else were just to start advocating for a position or belief that they believed. So it's important.
Gary, now, when people meet you, they think you're just a natural-born collaborator, the way you just bring people together. Has that always been the case, or did you have a defining moment that caused you to become that type of person?
I think it's just part of my DNA, honestly. My mom, my mom and my dad are both just naturally helpful people. They just like helping other people be successful. I've always just seen them step in, right, and do what others may not do. So I don't know, I get a lot of joy out of that. Legacy wise, that's what I just want to be known for, is someone that Well, I'd say it's pretty simple. Just someone that loves well. And I like what Erica said too about the inquisitive. I call it active listening. You're a very active listener, and then only then do you have the knowledge and the input from which you can actually have, I think, good discussion.
When it comes to listening and learning, I've found that nothing opens up your ears more and your mind more than you're doing something wrong. That's when you become in that learning mode. Can you all talk to us? Erica, starting with you. Give us an example of a mistake that you made. Because a lot of times when I talk to people, normally when they reached out to me, something is going wrong. Okay. And they are looking for advice. And a lot of times they are concerned that the mistake they made is fatal. And the advice I like to give them in that it isn't. But can you talk to us about one of your learning moments?
Sure. I think what I have learned over the years to be the most critical kinds of mistakes are mistakes that involve somehow hurting another person. So you can always come back to some extent from a technical issue or something that is less personal. But when you make a mistake that fundamentally hurts someone else, I think those are the much more difficult ones to recuperate from, both for you and the other person. So breaches of trust, violation, et cetera, I think are problematic. And I don't know that I intentionally ever want to hurt someone else. But I think there are times when I may have said something that came out hurtful or did something that had an impact on people that you certainly don't want to have. You know, as a leader, as someone who's making decisions all the time, some of those decisions can be rough when you're changing people's roles or jobs or, you know, that has an impact on their identity and their, some cases, their financial well-being. And I wouldn't say that those are necessarily mistakes, but they're definitely hard calls. I spend a lot of time thinking and reflecting about, could I have done those things differently? Could I have made a different decision that would have had less of an impact on that person? Not always would that be the case, but I certainly use those opportunities to think a lot about those kinds of choices and decisions that ultimately hurt others.
Gary, tell us about one of your biggest learning moments.
Oh, I make mistakes every day. So we could be here all day talking about all those things. Last week we had our big CIO roundtable ATP did with TAG. And one of the comments that was made by one of our panelists was by Mark Dawson. He's a vice president over at Cox. And he said, if you're going to fail, fail fast. Right. And I think a mistake that I've made in the past is why I try to correct a situation that may be uncorrectable, so to speak. Where if I had just taken the action sooner, I would have actually limited the pain, maybe the financial impact, the personal pain. So in mistake that I tend to make is extending a situation because I think I can change the outcome. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, but in retrospect, I think I could have made quicker decisions that would have been resulted in better results.
Making quicker decisions leading to better results. What is the number one thing that you are focusing in on to improve your leadership? Because you both have much broader responsibility now. And we talked about leaders being lifelong learners. Mm-hmm. So what aspect of your leadership are you focused in on the most now in improving?
For me, it's about having an enterprise perspective. As a faculty member and professor, my scholarship was in the area of crisis leadership. And one of the things that I observed leaders do, or managers who have found themselves in a crisis situation, is, for the most part, abdicate their decision-making because they thought, well, the lawyer is the expert, so I'm going to let him or her make this decision to get us out of this crisis. Or the HR person is the expert, so they're going to be responsible for making this decision. And I think what we fail to realize oftentimes is that those people have a functional expertise, but it's a narrow expertise. And as a leader, you have to see the entire enterprise and have the big picture. And their input, their advice should guide your decision-making, but it should not take place of your own decision-making. So I spend a lot of time making sure that I have a complete picture of what's going on in the enterprise, in the organization.
Gary, what area are you focusing in on with your leadership?
I was about to ask you to repeat the question. You know, it's just a daily review. For me, it's communication most of the time. It's consistent communication. Like Erica said, get a 360 perspective. Really listen. You know, I think a lot of times it's people that are under your supervision. They just want to make sure that they're being heard. They want to know how they fit into the overall plan. And I think the more that you communicate the vision, the mission, you know, what you're trying to accomplish and how they fit into the plan, the better. So it's just continuing to work on communications and diversity in communication. Pick up the phone. Mm-hmm. Quit sending the email. Don't text. Actually have a conversation. Go see somebody face-to-face. I think those types of things are pretty pretty logical, pretty common sense, but I think we can tend to get away from them in the technology age. Yeah.
When you mention common sense, someone mentioned to me that there's a big difference between common sense and common practice. And the connecting thread is how you treat people. And what I've been most impressed with both of your comments is the people thread throughout. I want to thank you all, both Erica and also Gary, for being on the show. And as you all were talking, it made me think back to when Steve Coonan, the president of the CEO of the Atlanta Hawks, and also of Phillips Arena, was on the show. And I asked him, he had changed jobs and just knocked the ball out of the park in so many different professions, from Coca-Cola to Turner to now with the Hawks. I asked him, what did he bring to each one of those roles that caused him to be so successful? And he said he brought the currency of ideas. That's what you could count on anytime he came into the room. In listening to you two, and also in meeting with you all, what you all bring, in my opinion, is the currency of trust. You have that special ability that when you talk with people, when you interact with people, even if you're viewing things from a different perspective, they know you, they can trust you. So thank you. And I don't know if you've ever thought about that's the currency that you bring, but I can tell you that's the currency that you have. Now, when you're in the room, what are you thinking about, what you're bringing to the room?
In which room?
Okay, in any room. Like in this room, well, I know that you brought in a perspective that we could all learn from. Mm-hmm. Now, when you're an executive, when you're in the room with all of the big shots at Emory and all these business leaders, what is Dean James bringing to the table?
I think I bring an ability, a real passion to make a difference and to help whoever is in the room with me. And if I remember that that is the focus, that they are the important party in the room, then everything else becomes easy. And I do think some of what Gary was saying in terms of the ability to listen, what I have tried to do with my leadership is to ask questions, to learn. I think I bring the ability to allow people a safe space to talk and share ideas.
Gary, what do you bring?
Really, it's similar to what Erica said. Just I walk into and hopefully I can make a positive impact for the people that are in the room, whether it's executives, whether it's team meeting, one-on-one situation. Just want to see how I can be helpful to that individual or individuals at that specific time.
Well, both of you all are making a tremendous difference in education, in the community, in the professional space, and I want to thank you. Thank you again, Dean James and Gary, for being on Change Leaders Exclusive. As our listeners know, we end each show with the Dallas Diamond. It's wisdom that was formed under pressure. And today's Dallas Diamond is that you stop leading once you stop learning.
I like it.
Once you start knowing all of the answers, but to the wrong questions, then you're no longer leading. So once you stop learning, you stop leading. That diamond came out of a conference I attended. It was a CIO conference. and they had just completed, I went to a session where they were showing the results of a just completed study of 2015 of how CIOs spent their time. And they showed it up on the screen. And immediately I said, time out. Now I'm in the audience. And the moderator said, excuse me, this is not time for Q&A. And I said, well, I'm not making a question. I'm not asking a question. I'm making a statement. Time I saw how they spent their time. And I saw nothing with customers. No time. No time on self-development. And very little time on staff development. I said, time out. We've got to change that. Because CIOs are at the heart of change taking place. And the only way we can understand the impact that that change is having on people is to spend time with people and spend time with ourselves. So the diamond, once you stop learning, you stop leading. Until next time, this is James Dallas, Change Leaders Exclusive.